All right, handouts made it around. Guess that's a yes. And pens needed? Yeah, what the heck, Jason? Ron needed handouts. I mean, come on. Okay, one at a time, we'll do the pen thing. As soon as one person's done asking for one, then the next person. Okay, huh? Anybody else need a pen? Going once, twice, sold. Okay. We'll do a little review, but today is going to be sort of a mixed bag. You're going to have to really focus as we move through some concepts because it's not going to necessarily be immediately clear. But here's the first big thing, and we'll just read this together. Part one, none of us should assume or expect that the large decisions we must make, decisions regarding opportunity, decisions concerning risk, decisions that will turn our lives from dull or ordinary or merely self-satisfying pursuits, ones that will have consequential outcomes for others we care about. Those decisions, that they can be made with ease or with haste, or that they can be made with little or no anguish or searching. If the result of a decision will loom large and life-altering, then we should expect that the process of deciding should be temporarily consuming. So how many of you have been in a season where you just wish the decision was over? Something big. If I could just... And we don't like the process. There's an interesting proverb that I put right here below this. The purposes of a person's heart are deep water, but the one who has insight draws them out. That's interesting because the one being described is the same one. So the person, you and I, that is, we have a lot of things that fit us for making a particular decision. Do you know yourself? Do you know what's going into you? Do you know why you think the way you think, like what you like, run toward what you run toward, and avoid what you avoid? Do you know you well enough? Because this is what it's saying. There are decisions that sort of cry out to be made based on who we are, but if we never take the time to know who we really are, then we can't make decisions that are right for us. So remember what we said already. What are some of the filters? We're going to add a new one today. What are some of the filters that we use through which to pass our decisions? So let the outer box here, again, we're going to use this same tired, boring box. Let the outer box represent all of the possible outcomes or options available to us. What's the first filter that we pass through?
God's will.
Okay, you're not looking at your notes, right? Okay. Okay, so the first one is God's love. Love. We don't just say God's law, we say God's law of love, because whenever we say just God's law, what does that sound like? Oh, it's just one more thing I got to do to make God happy. And it puts all the focus on God as if the reason we make the decision is to make God happy. What does that make God into? Well, heartless and forceful, right? He doesn't really care about what's best for us. He just cares about what makes him happy. That makes him very little better than most of us on a bad day, right? So we call it God's law of love because it really does embrace what's good for us. What's the next filter? I'll take them in any order. I'm desperate here.
Bringing glory to God.
There you go. That's not only a filter, that's in order. The next one is, does it have the potential, we said. You don't know that, but does it have the potential to bring either glory or honor to God? Or does it run the risk of doing the opposite? Which is another part of that question. So does it have the potential to bring glory to God? Does it run the risk of dishonoring God? What's another one?
Our skill set.
Okay, good one. So skills, we said, talents, and then as believers... Scripture says that we've each been given unique gifts that God gives to us to serve others. Other one? There's another one.
Purpose.
Purpose. Our life purpose. All right. We said there was one other one yet that we got to consider inside of there. Remember, we've said that the overlap of these two, where these two tend to merge at some point, that's a good fit for us. What's the next one? There's one other one we said. He said, how does it impact other people? That we cannot ignore this, that we are not isolated islands, that we need to take into account how our decisions are going to benefit or harm other people. All right, so in light of this, again, let's read this proverb. Jim, do you need notes? Do you have notes? You probably don't have notes because you walked in at the end there. The purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, but the one who has insight draws them out. We said last week that it should be our mission throughout all of life to be acquiring more of three things that will help us to make better decisions. Anybody remember what they were? The first is knowledge, information and knowledge, because we cannot have better, the next thing, understandings, until we have better information and knowledge. And we said that understanding is the way we link the pieces of information or knowledge that we have. So I develop a more complete understanding of how life is, what life is, how I am and what I am, based on the knowledge that I receive. And then out of that is the wisdom that I have for action. So wisdom becomes the action-oriented component of understanding. How long does it take to do all that? A very long time, a lifetime. And so when we look at this, again, let's read this. The purposes of a person's heart are deep water, but the one who has insight draws them out. Have you ever crossed a stream? And I don't mean the kind that's this deep and there's stones that go out. Have you ever waded through a stream? And okay, maybe there were some rocks, but you made a bad step. Or maybe you made the right step, but it was a slippery rock, and there you are, right? And you're in up to here. And, well, at this point, you're wet, and there's no point in trying to get back on the slippery rock anyway, so you might as well just wade the rest of the way through. Now, if the water is shallow, you have this advantage. You can see where you're going to put your foot next. But what if the water is deep? And what if the water is wide? Because this is the kind of thing that's being embraced. Remember when these words are written, you didn't just go downstream a quarter mile to the bridge and cross there. If you wanted to get from one side of the land to the other, and there was water in between, what did you have to do? You just had to wade through it. And so, in this metaphor, and that's what all these proverbs are, they're one life experience being used to describe another life experience. So he's using the description of trying to wade through deep water and using that as a description for how we go about making tough decisions. And he says the first thing we have to do is get to know what's inside of us. Jim?
When you're doing that deep water crossing, you either A, are with somebody, because you don't do that by yourself. B, you have something in your hands to be able to poke in front of you to find out what is there, because what if it goes deeper, you know what I mean? And now you're swept into rushing water. You mean, there's ways to cross that are tactically done better.
Mm-hmm.
Than just like, hey, let's just, you know, plow into this thing and risk life away. So when they're, you know what I mean? Like, there's ways to do that. I was thinking about this. Well, I crossed water differently today than I did when I was a child. You know, even when we were a kid, you were just like, you just go flying in. And now I think about it. Now, wait a minute. What if there's piranha in there?
Now, I have to understand, I'm the only one looking this way, so I'm looking at Jim Holt and thinking to myself, what would it look like for Jim Holt to be wading through deep water? I just don't even, I can't put that and the deep water together.
What? The things he said depend on how much wisdom you've acquired at that point.
Mm-hmm. That's how you acquire it.
But the one who has insight draws them out. And I want to just come back one more time before we move on. Why should we expect our biggest decisions to be made easily? But yet we do. We want something to just be done and over with and moved on because we're people of action. So it has any one of us... What?
No.
No what?
We're not people of action.
Well, no, we are, because we would rather act than think. I think that there are many people who would rather do anything than think. Right? And it doesn't mean that the actions are great actions. Let me finish. Have you ever avoided the upfront work and rushed into something only to think afterwards, boy, I should have given this more thought? I mean, for most of us, it might be, have you ever rushed into a home improvement project? We'll call it project loosely, right? Have you ever rushed into a home improvement project only to say to yourself afterwards, geez, I should have known a little bit more about this, done a little bit more research, seen what I was up against before? And if you're not the one who's thinking that after the fact, you live with somebody who is asking that after the fact. Geez, I wish you would have done more research into the fact that there's contractors out there who could have done this, or whatever it is. All right. So, here's the point. Take the time. Take the time that's necessary to make a good decision. Don't be frustrated when it takes a while. Don't be shocked at how difficult it is and expect there to be pain.
Well, if you want to use the financial world, everybody wants the payoff at retirement. But not everybody's willing to invest up front. It hurts. Why? Well, because you don't get to get the new car. Why? Because you're putting it in savings. You don't get to get the new bike. Why? Because you're putting it in savings. You don't get to get that next new cool little shiny thing. Why? Because it's going into savings. Why? For later. And so a lot of people, you know what I mean? And wisdom is the same thing. They don't see knowledge or understanding in things. They just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I suppose some days you have to do that. Wake up, breathe in, and not put one foot in front of the other. In the process, do yourself a favor. Try to talk to a few people with some wisdom, some understanding and knowledge to help you get the rules out.
Okay, we're going to read again because some of the things that I've written are just, I don't know, it just makes more sense to read them. I had a meeting the other night with Vinny, and well, that's what I said afterwards too, but you know, he used a couple of phrases that we've all used at times, but they were fresh in my mind, and so I thought, you know what, they're good. Let's just use them here. There are things you have seen which you cannot unsee. And probably he remembers saying that. Experiences you've had that you cannot unhave. Training you've received, preparation undergone, parenting received or not, and so many other things which have made of you who you are right now. They, all of them, are the things which have become part of your knowledge and your understanding. These things will cause you to be drawn to certain people, to certain needs, to certain opportunities. Right? That's why the things that appeal to one person don't appeal to another. This is part of getting to know yourself. Why are you drawn to these certain things? And then what do you do about them? And here's the thing, and I want to come back to what I borrowed from Vinny. What do you do with the things that you've seen that you'd rather not have seen, but now you can't think about life in the same way? Do you just ignore them and move on with your everyday life? Or do you have to redecide once you've seen something? Do you have a path charted out for your life, and it was simple, and it was easy, and it was pleasant, and it was going to take you to all the right places that you wanted to go? As a matter of fact, we probably all have had that plan. And then you see something or have a conversation with someone, and it opens up your understanding in a way that you either have to shove that back into some recess of your thinking and never think about it again, or it has to change the course of your life. And for some of us, we're there now, or we have been, or we're living the life that is the result of having had that course change. And then there's the other thing that happens. Listened to a good interview a couple of weeks ago and made me think about this. Most of us have watched some good movies. How do you know when something bad is just about to happen?
Music.
It is, isn't it? Right? It's some ominous music, right? And then what happens? We become upset because we've been tricked, right? Because sometimes the ominous music plays and then nothing happens. You were ready for the bad guy to jump or something to happen and then nothing happens.
Or the music doesn't.
But what kind of soundtrack is running in our minds when we go to make decisions? What is the experience that's running in the background? What is the negative, the fear, the uncertainty? Maybe it's not even our own. Maybe it's something that's been planted into us. What is the soundtrack that's creating what we call dissonance? We want to do one thing, but we're thinking or experiencing something else, and it's preventing us from making a decision. Do you know what that is in your life? You know that decision there, or that phrase, I should say, that a lot of people say, and they say, what great thing would you do if you couldn't fail? Now, why doesn't everybody do that? That great thing? Because we all know people who have failed, right? Isn't that the soundtrack that's playing in our mind? Sure, we'd all do things if we knew we couldn't fail, but we know differently. We know that people try things and do fail. And that's running in the back of our mind. You're shaking your head.
I wish we could get to a place in this country again where it didn't matter if you failed. Get up. You know what I mean? What's his face? The great coach. That thing makes cowards of us all. Fatigue makes cowards of us all. Everyone. So just keep moving. Don't worry about it. Just stay after it. But what happens is we become so afraid to fail because the world says this about failure. You know, I don't know what happened. I guess I've been listening to some stuff over the past 15 months with what's going on in the election, and I hear the direction that this country is headed, and I think to myself, we're off the cliff. It's almost too late to turn back and get back to a place where hard work and some wisdom put food on the table, and it was okay. And if you fail, that's right. Don't panic. You're not fired. We just have to fix that. You know, an old man used to say that. Don't worry. Do something. Even if we'll fix it tomorrow. But do something. We've all become so afraid to do anything. You know? And it just drives me nuts.
And I just want to remind you what Paul Weibel said when you said that the other week. And he counterpoled, well, sometimes when you're a surgeon, you can't say that. Don't worry. We'll fix it tomorrow. Sometimes you have to make the right decision. But I'm not disputing what you're...
But there's a difference between... wisdom. I mean, that's
right.
What wisdom is for.
Right,
so
exactly.
If you're headed down that road of doing something, do something. Make a sound decision and do it. Because Paul knows better than me that if you do nothing, he's going to die.
Okay.
Somewhere along the line, we went from it being the learning curve to fail.
Yeah.
To failing, meaning I'm a failure.
90% is failing. Christian, get 100. Sorry.
Well, when you set the bar for success reasonably high and failure is anything other than that, then it's easy to fail. And this, the bar of success in our country right now is a degree of prosperity and comfort. And now it's sometimes easy to slip from that perch. Right, and so sometimes we set our... Define your success, and it will then determine your failure. So if you've defined your success at reaching a certain level of whatever it is, then anything less than that is a failure. But if your success is a little bit more broad, if it's defined by what you're willing to risk in the hope of gaining something good... And remember several weeks ago we said, you may never reach the goal. You personally may never reach the goal. The scriptures are filled with stories of people who never saw the thing they set out to accomplish.
What do you mean I don't get to go?
But yet they considered their part to be valuable. And if you lay down your life, so to speak, so that the next generation can reach something...
And in our country, how many have done that? Laid down their life so that the next guy behind him could get 6 more yards down the path.
Well, it is the story of the founding and the development of our country. We might question whether it is the condition of our country at present. And I don't, again, I mean, we could go off in the weeds politically here, but I think we can do this safely. Why do you take us to these bad places that force me to speak about things that I'd rather not speak about?
Because we need to talk about the things that we'd rather not talk about, and we don't do that in this country.
Okay, okay, okay. Somebody needs to go put his leash on again. And
there aren't any dads that sit down at the table and say, you know what, we're going to have this hard conversation right now. We're not doing this. We don't live like that, and you're not going to do that. We can't do that.
Okay.
So... Talk.
Y'all had your moment to put his leash on, and you didn't. Now he's eating too much red meat, and he's going to be too mean to...
What I will say, though...
Go ahead.
Without getting off on a tangent here...
Oh, heck, you may as well go for it.
Oh, yeah.
Does it really matter what our measure of success is in the world? Yes. Why? Because people look to us. I look to Glenn to teach me. So the matter of the success with which he teaches matters to me. It matters. Because if I don't think that he can do the job, I'm not going to follow him. People don't follow us anymore. Why?
Us? You mean Christians? Is that what you're saying? Us or successful people? See, I look at success now. Success to me isn't the house, the car, the job.
Oh, no,
success
no, no, no.
to me is growing in wisdom and stature like Jesus. That's to be more Christ-like.
Yes.
To not listen to the world that tells me who I am and why I should be successful.
Character.
I want to gain understanding through the Holy Spirit, through the guidance of the Holy Spirit, through truth and righteousness. You know, the first thing up there says God's law and love. Well, in John it says, if you love me, you will obey my commands. That doesn't mean we won't sin. We have to abide in him. If we abide in him, we will be led by the Holy Spirit in truth and righteousness, and we will obey the law. So the measure of success in this world, I don't care if somebody looks at me and says, oh, you wash toilets?
Yeah.
Ah, but you know what?
Most of the world.
I know the Father. I don't care what you think about me cleaning toilets.
I do. And when I'm done with them, they're the cleanest ones in the building.
Exactly. My father told me one time, he said, son, you know what? If your job is cleaning toilets, make sure it's spick and shiny, because somebody's going to notice someday and you're going to be acknowledged for your hard work.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, I don't care about that man that acknowledges my hard work. It's important because I have job security.
But
you know what? The Lord is going to provide for me no matter what I
do. You still care.
All right. At this point, I think we are going to rein it back in just a little bit.
You're still supposed to do it. What? Your dad told you to do it like that. Why?
No. My dad told me, you're working unto the Lord and not to man. So at the end of the day, you're not working for your boss. Yes, he may sign your paycheck, but ultimately, you have to answer to the Father.
Why?
The Father said, work unto me as though you... And not man, correct?
Okay, but what's the next outcome? Why do it to me like that? Why do that for me like that? Because this goes further than that. Because the guy behind you says, man, why do you do that like that? Well, you asked, so sit down now, I'm going
to
tell you.
And that leads us where? Right to the second filter. Does it have the potential to bring glory and honor to God?
That's all of it right there.
What you say is good, but too many people don't think they have to listen to the Father. A lot of people.
Oh, you mean a lot of people that walk with Jesus? Or are you talking about the world?
The world.
But the only thing we can do is show them our life and how we live, and we are the example.
Okay, but even within that general sense of what you just described, there are still specific decisions that each of us has to make. Otherwise, the world would be very narrow and focused, and a lot of opportunities would remain unseized. A lot of good things would remain undone. So, yes, these are broad filters. So what you described was out here, but there's still a lot of deep water to go through to get to the personal decisions that you need to make. All right. We're just going to return to the lesson. We're not going any further afield. We are not. Part two, everyone has a story. So think about the story that you want your life to tell when your life isn't your life anymore. And there's an interesting verse that I said here. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen well to my words of insight that you may maintain discretion and your lips may preserve knowledge. Now, in some translations, and this is what caught my attention, that your lips may guard knowledge. So a guard stands between one thing and another. All right? So the guard in this case, the lips, again, a metaphor, is guarding what's already been experienced in the mind from those outside, and it's going to selectively share things. You know, I'm convinced that there are a lot of us that come to things like this and we sit here, but we don't do anything with what we come here and hear. The proof of that is that we stay the size we are and essentially reach no one else. And my question is this: what are you going to do with what you're hearing? Is it in any way going to change what's inside that you were selectively revealing and releasing to other people? And over the course of a lifetime, what are you going to share with other people? Let's move down to the second bulleted point. You will have two kinds of stories to tell. You cannot live your whole life without ever becoming the example of what not to do. So we can just stop right there, right? In what ways is your life the example of what not to do? We all have those stories. I have plenty, right? I could not only fill a chapter, most of my life's book would be about do not do this. As a matter of fact, frankly, I'm here today. I'm here every week because of all the don't do this anymore stuff that has happened in my life. But I'm only here not just because of that. I'm here because every other man is the same way. So we want our story to be about all the good things we did and right. We want it to be the two chapters somewhere in the Bible where it was really great. But it's not. It's not. It's the don't do this again. Nope, don't.
And isn't that so much of wisdom? Very little of wisdom is do this. A whole lot is do that.
And it's okay, but you should also have stories that tell you what you have chosen to do, which has been the catalyst for a work of God to begin in you and through you. So you want to have a couple of stories to tell in your life about how you made the first step, you took the first risk, and God showed up, and the two of you together did something big. Don't just avoid being the main character in the I was stupid story. Although it's certainly a great place to start, it is not a worthy objective. You understand what I'm saying there? If you spend your whole life living to avoid failing, in the end, you don't have much of a story to tell. The story of your life, if at the end of it, you can, and we all know people who have the beautiful life. The beautiful life is it's comfortable, it's easy, they go nice places, they see nice things, they enjoy each other's company all the time, they never fight, it's the beautiful life, but they never do anything that really matters. So if you were to...
Larry in there?
He is not.
Sorry about that.
But if you remove them from humanity, what's lost? There's not a lot lost. And there's a whole lot of us that are living the let's just make life work. Instead of at that moment of decision saying, you know what, this is worth the risk, and even if it fails, even if it doesn't become a happy ending, it was worth trying. Seek to be an actor in the I set out to do this worthy thing and God has been my companion and leader in it movie of life. All right, I said I would introduce a new filter today. Does anybody have any comments, questions before we move on? So that was part two. Part one is expect decisions to be hard. Big decisions should be hard. Big decisions should take a long time. If your big decisions don't take you but 5 minutes, be concerned. Part number two is at the end of your life, you want something to have to share with others about the big things that God and you have done together. And if all the stories of your life are about how God provided for my needs, God provided for this, God provided for that. If you were never in really deep water, and you were never up the proverbial creek without a paddle, and you were never at the edge of your seat and fearful once in your life that everything you had was on the line, then maybe your life has not been lived boldly enough. That was part two. So now we get into part three, which is the next filter. Determining and living in the season you are in. What I'd like us to do is just turn over to Psalm 90. Thank you.
Before you go on, I'm not sure I agree with that last statement about not living boldly enough. I think there's some people that live a life of small pushes all through their life. Maybe none of them are giant pushes, but at the end, they have a huge impact, at least on their circle. There's a lot of George Baileys out there that you don't realize it until it's too late.
Fair enough.
However, in George Bailey's life, because that is my wife's absolute favorite movie. You have to watch every Christmas. George Bailey did great things, and he may not have perceived them as great things. And I think that's so oftentimes is what happens, is we don't perceive them as great things, but the people around us do. But we don't talk to them, and we don't ask them, and we don't really confide in other people. We live as an island in the world, and we, you know what I mean? So I just think that we have to look at individuals. You said it at the beginning. What am I doing individually? Not that. Am I taking an inventory of what I have and letting God use me to the best of my ability? Am I letting God, build my character? Is my character the best that it can be, or am I just kind of like you said, wading through shallow water, making sure it's safe, not getting involved, staying out of things? Or am I stepping in the gap and saying, hey, wait a minute. I know not everybody can do that, but everyone should. Especially if you're a Christian. You step into the gap and you go, whoa, Nehemiah.
Well, some people step into the gap with their words. Some people step into the gap with their lives. Some people serve in the gap. Some people speak in the gap. Both are necessary.
But for us as Christians, we can start looking at those people.
And everything that he said was true, but it gets down right there. Have you ever found it easy to make a decision as long as the only person that would be hurt if it went bad was you? But as soon as you start to think about your wife, your kids, your friends, or whatever, then's when the decision is hard. But yet the kind of decision making that Jim was talking about, where you make your stand, where you decide this and no more, it's not just going to affect you. It's going to affect everyone that's close to you, and that's what makes it so difficult. And I want us to understand that. So when Jim says something like that, we all leave here, and it was the typical motivational rah-rah pep talk. Yeah, we're going to do that. And then you think, well, no, wait a minute. And we've all watched movies like that, right? Who usually, in the movie like that, pays the price for the hero's stand? It's his family, right? When he's away somewhere, the bricks come through the home of, who's at home? The wife and the kids. Who gets ridiculed? The kids in school. Who gets ridiculed? The wife somewhere. And so when we make those bold stands, we need to understand we're not just making that decision for ourselves, we're making it for everyone else who has chosen to link up with us and go along for us with on the ride with us. And that's what makes it tough. That's why it's important that we think about that part. All right. Next filter, determining and living in the season you are in. This single statement lifted from Psalm 90, and we've heard it a lot, but let's look at it together. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. So we'll look at the verse first, and then I want us to read through the entire Psalm. Teach us to number our days correctly, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. All right, so we've already said this, but again, so that we're sure that we understand the verse, there's a lot of stuff here. What's the heart?
The place of making all our decisions.
Okay. It's the seat of reason and decision making. And so we've won a heart of wisdom. And that's what we've said again and again, that wisdom allows us to make better decisions. We should be cultivating wisdom throughout our whole life. And so what is Moses saying is one of those pieces of wisdom that we need to have? To be able to number our days. To understand what season of life you're in. When you want to make a decision, you need to understand what season of life you are in right now. Let's go back and read this together. Start at the very beginning, and I'll try to read it quickly, but there's a lot of good stuff here. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, you brought forth the earth and the world. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So if we were going to draw a picture of this, we would say, this is God. All right? And the line could go off that end, the line could go off that end. That's your life. That's the first perspective. So understanding what season you're in, this is God, this is you. This is how long God's time frame and reference is. This is your time reference. You turn men back to dust, saying, return to dust, O sons of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that's just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They're like the new grass of the morning, though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it is dry and withered. What season of life do you suppose Moses is in when he's writing this? It's poetic, right? And it is. It is poetic. So you don't want to take all this 100% literally, but he's expressing some profound ideas. Well, what do you suppose? Do men in their 20s write this kind of verse? They don't, right? Because they haven't gotten to the withered part. They haven't seen that. They don't. Right? When you're 20, life seems to stretch on out forever. When you're 80, and you look back, and this is one of the contradictions that he expresses. When you're 80 and you look back, it's like, wow, didn't last as long as I thought it would. And yet, verse 7. Do you see the first part? Every new generation, they are like new grass in the morning. Though in the morning they spring up new, by evening it's dry and withered. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. So here's what he's depicting. Here's God. And this is what Moses is feeling like in the minute. Okay, that's my sin, that's my sin, that's my sin. Yeah, I did that too, that, and that. And every day, Moses is saying, God sits there and he just looks at them. And he looks at me, and he looks at them, looks at me. And pretty soon, Moses is saying, this is all God sees about me. And he's just reflecting and meditating. Is this what he thinks about me? This right here? All our days pass away under your wrath, and we finish our years with a moan. Right, now remember what he just said a moment ago. How did he just describe our lives a moment ago? We're like grass. We're green in the morning, and by evening, we're gone. We're withered. And yet now look at how he describes it. All our days pass away under your wrath, and we finish our years with a moan. Does that sound long or short now? It sounds kind of long. Right? And so this is the experience. Sorry, I got to borrow my sin back so I can use it to write with. And it's written down there, but we're going to look at it again. If this whole thing represents our life, it doesn't seem that big as a life. But when we look at it a day at a time, seems pretty long. And so here's the way I worded it in your notes there. The days are long, but the decades are short. Right? Think about when you're in pain, how long does that day last if you have a headache? If you have a backache? I mean something real that aches. I don't mean just something minor. What does that day last feel like? Last like? It takes a long time, doesn't it? There's something interesting that I read a couple of weeks ago, and it has to do with, and we've talked about this before, as far as the human being's fluidity of memory. In other words, we don't tend to remember things as they are, that they kind of tend to morph and adapt in our mind as we move on, which is why you and somebody else experience the exact same thing, and they say, no, no, it was like this, and you say, no, it was like that, and you were both right there in the room together, and it's because our memories are a little bit fluid. But here's something else it described about the difficulties and the traumas in life. It says, typically, the human mind remembers the peak difficulty, the peak pain, and then it remembers when it was done. And it doesn't remember a lot in between. It's like, oh my word, this was awful. Thankfully, it's done. The length of our days is 70 years or 80. If we have the strength, yet their span is but trouble and sorrow. and they quickly pass away and pass, and we fly away. Now, what an interesting statement, because in one sentence, he embraces all of this. Every day feels so long, and yet life as a whole seems so short. The overarching theme here, though, is who knows the power of your anger? For your wrath is as great as the fear that is due you. Now, if you know something about Moses' story, this all starts to make sense, right? What's he doing? He's leading a group of rebellious people that have already said no to God at times when that turned out to be really disadvantageous for them, to say no. To say no to God when it was, okay, it's time to cross into the land that I've given you. No, I don't think we're going to do that today. Okay, well, fine. Then I don't think you're going to do that at all, God says. Well, no, wait. If that's the way you put it, God, okay, we have a change of heart. We will go into the land. And then God says, no, now you won't. And from that moment on, they begin a wandering in the desert that just never seems to end. And as they do that, they have all the time in the world. What do you do when you're in the desert and you're walking around in circles? I mean, what do you do? What do you have time to do? You have a lot of time to think. And so, one moment you're thinking, boy, I wish we would have. Have you ever lived in the land of, boy, I wish I would have? Right? Some of us carry that land around with us for the rest of our lives. Boy, I wish I would have. And at the same time, as we're living in that land, there's only one thing left to think about. Boy, I wish I had. And they live there too. Boy, I wish I had some better food to eat. Boy, I wish I had a little bit more water to drink. Boy, I wish I could have a better place to live. Boy, I wish I had. And when boy, I wish I had lives in the same house with boy, I wish I would have, that makes for a really unhappy life. Now imagine a million people in the desert living a really unhappy life. You with me? You know what Moses is? Moses is the leader of a million unhappy people. What does it feel like to be Moses every day? And you got to understand, right? The people that are, boy, I wish I would have, boy, I wish I had, when they go to Moses, they're not saying, wow, Moses, great job leading today. People that live there don't say that to their leaders. What do they say?
Why didn't you let us die?
Or, it's kind of got to be somehow your fault that we're in this mess. This was your idea. I don't know about this. God, we can't see. But you invited us to come out on this journey. Now, what does it feel like to be that guy? And remember, this was a choice. How many days does Moses think to himself, boy, I wish I would have never walked over to that freaking burning bush. And yet at the same time, right? He's old now. At the same time, and this is conjecture. So you can buy into this or you don't have to. I believe the burning bush was the final straw. I believe that this idea of going back and leading the people out had been on Moses' mind for a while already. And it's like, this is the thing. We're waiting for God to give us the ultimate sign. If you're waiting for God to give you the ultimate sign, it means that it's already on your mind to begin with. Right? Otherwise, you wouldn't be looking for a sign. You're not looking for a sign for something that you're not already thinking about. So if you're already thinking about it, what are the chances that maybe that's something that you should be moving toward already? And so I can't help but think, when what's got to be 100-year-old man stuck in the desert with a million unhappy people, thinking to himself, boy, every day God is just, he's not happy. He doesn't seem to be happy. My life doesn't feel happy. Is he thinking to himself, maybe I should have seized that opportunity years ago. Maybe I should have done this sooner. And then at the end of that, he says, who knows the power of your anger? For your wrath is as great as the fear that is due to you. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Relent, O Lord, how long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love. So in the end, here's the final thing that he says. Well, our days are long and our decades are short. While the opportunity that we don't take today may haunt us for years to come, is one final thing that he's saying in all of this. That the disobedience that we enact today haunts us for decades to come. Why are they living under what Moses perceives to be this anger? Why is that what Moses is writing about and thinking about? Why is he so sensitive right now to God's anger? Because it's really a big theme in this little poem here. Because he's thinking every moment that we disobey produces a break in relationship and a frustration, and even if God isn't actually angry, we perceive it as anger at our disobedience. Numbering our days suggests that we're going to have to live with regret for every moment that we choose to step outside what God would want for us. And as an older man, what he's saying is, that's probably not a good way to spend the rest of your days. For every moment of disobedience, I'm later on going to harvest a season of consequence and regret. So if I don't want to harvest the season of consequence and regret later, maybe it would just be actually more pleasant to obey now, even if it's hard, and then harvest later on the delight and the joy of God. And remember, these are the words of an older guy. And not an older guy who's what we would call a schmuck who never did anything. This is a guy who did something with his life. This is a man that, whose words we could actually respect. And this is his musings about what life is like. Okay, so point number one to take away from that. Life is short. At least as we experience it in the day. Here's the next thing. And this is where we said this is a filter. What season of life are you in? Remember how we started this. Teach us to number our days. Certain opportunities are available to us each day. They're not seasonal. They're ours to seize and enjoy each day. What are the things that are available to you every day that you can take advantage of and you don't? What are the small joys and satisfactions that you can take advantage of every day? And you just put them off. Right? And there's a balance between nose to the grindstone, and you're going to look back one day and you're going to say, okay, what happens with people whose nose is to the grindstone all the time, right? They end up with a flat nose. They end up with no joy. They end up with no happiness. Have you ever postponed happiness for a long, long time? If I can just get through this season, if I can just get through this season, if I can just do this, if I can just do that. There's things that we need to take advantage of every day. And yet at the other time, here's the other filter that we need to run this through. There are things that are right for one season in your life that are not right for another season in your life. So if you're frustrated because you feel you should be doing, but you can't, maybe it's just that the season is wrong. Let me use the low-hanging fruit illustration. Okay, I always do this and people then laugh at the stupid illustrations, but that's okay. It helps to make the point. So if you're 15 years old and you live in Aboriginal culture and you think to yourself one day, I wonder if I should get married. And then you think to yourself in the next moment, yeah, I think I will get married. Is that a good decision when you're 15 and you live... Well, if you're 15 and you live in an Indian tribe... where you don't have to go through 10 years of advanced education and training, and 15 is the normal age to marry, then it's a good decision. But what if you're 15 and you live in the United States and you're not quite through with 11th grade? See, then it's an okay decision. It's just not an okay decision for now. There's nothing wrong with getting married. It's just you're not in the right season. So for the Aboriginal guy, yes, it's a good decision, and it's maybe even the right season in his life to get married. But if you live in the United States, and you have X years of education to get through yet, maybe 15 is not the right time to get married. Good choice, wrong time. You're not in the right season. All right, that's the front end. That's, it will be available to you. But can you let good opportunities slip by and you will lose the season and never be able to get it back? All right, so when is the best season to be an outstanding dad to your kids who are at home? Is it after they've left or while they're still at home? It was sort of a trick question, but it illustrates the point. Right? It doesn't mean that for the rest of your life, you will be a father to kids who are at home. I mean, unless you keep having kids, in which case, yes, that's a natural outgrowth of that. But assuming that you limit the quantity at some upper end somewhere, sooner or later, the last one is going to grow up and hopefully leave home, and then you will have a new season of your life. So don't despair if you have a dream and you're just not in the right season of life. It's a final filter that we want to look at as we make big decisions. Are you in the right season to make this choice in the moment? Or can you with peace say, that is a commitment that I will make now to do this thing in the future, I just won't do it now. Okay. I think what we're going to do, we're going to bypass that next part and maybe come back to it. What I'd like us to do is go over to the book of Ruth. Ruth. The book of Ruth is right after, if you're using an actual written thing, is right after the book of Judges. Now, if you're using a digital device that just takes you automatically to things that you never need to actually figure out where books are in the Bible, then you're probably there right now, are you not? Yeah. Ruth, the first chapter. All right, now we all know the book of Ruth, or I assume we know the book of Ruth, or the story, or at least we know a little bit about it. So there's this guy and his wife, and they've got a couple of kids, and things are not going well in the land that they live. And we're going to look at the story in a little bit more detail in a minute. But they decide that they're going to, in the midst of a famine, leave the land. This is one of these big decisions. But we're going to look at the story in a little bit more richness, and I swear, when you read the beginning of this and you read through it at certain points, you would swear that this is an allegory. I mean, that's just how well it's set up. And then you realize at the end, when it introduces by name specific people as part of the Hebrew genealogy, you realize this cannot be an allegory. This is real history. And as real history, it is as if God has written and crafted a human allegory. I mean, with real people as the actors in this play. In the days when the judges ruled, okay, then that's a telling statement. It means that there is no king in the land. There is no overarching leader. There is not one person. There is not a Moses. There is not a Joshua. There is not a national leader that is there to help to unify the people to solve the problem. As a matter of fact, if you look at the end of the book of Judges, it says that during that season, does anybody remember how the book of Judges closes? It says, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Every man made his own decisions about what was right. He made the decisions for his household. But if the guy 5 miles down the street had a different collection of rules that he wanted to live by, that's how he lived. Every man, every clan, every tribe did what was right in their own eyes. So, in those days, there was a famine in the land. And there would have been no national leader to help to address and solve this problem. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and his two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. So Moab's maybe, depending on how you map it out and where they end up in Moab, Moab is maybe a 40-50 mile walk. Some people actually suggest it's only like 20 or 25 miles. That seems almost impossible. It's no more than 100 miles, no matter how you slice it. The man's name, now this is instructive, the man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. Okay, so I'm going to stop and I'm going to introduce the guys again, but this time I'm going to, we all know that the Hebrew names tend to have meaning and significance to them. The man's name was God is my king, and he was married to the Lord has made my life pleasant. Okay, so God is my king and his wife, the Lord has made my life pleasant, live with their two sons. You ready for their two sons' names? Telling you, you can't make this stuff up. Here are the two sons' names. The first is sad and sick, and the second one is failing. Okay, so God is my king, who is married to, the Lord has made my life rich and pleasant, and their two sons, sad and sick and failing, find themselves in a land where there's famine. Have you ever found yourself in a real mess? You know the way life is supposed to work. You know the way God is supposed to work. After all, you read it in the Bible and you understand that God is supposed to do certain things for His people. And when God's people do the things the right way, God is supposed to bless and honor them. And when they don't do things the right way, well, then God doesn't bless and honor them. Well, the people have not exactly been doing what honors and blesses God. That's the story of the book of Judges. God sends a leader to bail them out of the mess they've gotten themselves into. They live righteously for a while. They fall back into all this mess. And then God has to send another leader. It just repeats itself. Well, anyway, God is my king. My life is pleasant because of God. And their two sons, sad and failing, are in the famine. And they decide, this is God is my king's decision. God is my king. Now remember, God is my king. Decide that the best thing to do is leave the country that God gave to them and go to another country. So God is my king says to his wife, God ain't making things work here. Let's go to the land next door and maybe it will be better for us. And so they leave and they go to the land next door. Okay, you ready? Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died and she was left with her two sons. Okay, so this is all she's got left. She's got sick and failing. Does her life feel a lot like God has blessed me immensely? My life is rich. My life is bountiful. And she's a woman in a time when it's not good to be a woman and be alone, right? And her two sons are there. Now, her sons are not as attached to the land. Right? We assume that they left unmarried. They get married in the land of Moab. It says that in a minute. Which means that they're reasonably young. They're not greatly attached to the land. And so they marry women from Moab. One decision after another decision after another decision. We're not saying that any one of them is right or wrong. It was actually okay for them to marry Moabite women. That was not prohibited. Was it wise? Well, we don't know that. And we're not in a position to judge that. The amazing thing is, as I researched this story a lot this week, the spectrum of people who claim to know the right interpretation of this story is just mind-numbing. There are people who are condemning them for everything, right? Well, they should have just stayed in the land and trusted God. What do you do when you don't have food to feed your family? What do you do when every day you have less to eat than you had the day before? Do you leave town before there's nothing to eat and you literally don't have the energy to leave town anymore to go look for food and then you really are in a jam? Or do you leave town while it's bleak but there's still some hope that you might be able to find something 50 or 100 miles away? There's no clear answer provided. It's not as if we're told, well, this was definitely a bad answer, or this was definitely a right answer. See, we want God to put His signature of approval on our decisions, and that's not there. So if you've ever found yourself in a quandary where you had to make the decision, and you were looking for God's voice to say, yep, that's the way, and it doesn't happen, then you're exactly where these people were. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. And they married Moabite women. One was named Orpah, and the other Ruth. After that, they had lived there about 10 years. So they're there a long time. Where were you 10 years ago? Just think about that. Where were you there 10 years ago? It's hard even to remember, isn't it? But if you can remember, does it feel like it was just yesterday, or does it feel like a while ago? Nobody can even remember 10 years ago, can they? You're all looking at me. Huh? You're trying to think. Well, it's long enough that it doesn't feel like just yesterday. 10 years is a pretty long time. There's a lot of water under the bridge history that happens in 10 years. If you lived somewhere 10 years, would you start to call that place home? Right? Most of us, if we live somewhere for a year, it starts to feel like home. So surely at the end of 10 years, it starts to feel like home. This is their place. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion, those are the kids, right? Those are sick and failing, also died. And Naomi was left without her sons and her husband. Okay, so now here's this woman. She's left by herself. She's got two daughters-in-law, both mourning the loss of their husbands. What does it feel like to be Naomi now? Hey, can you feel that a little bit? And then she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them. Naomi and her daughter-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Now, here's the interesting thing. If Naomi had been a jerk, what are the odds that the daughters-in-law would have even thought about going back? Like, why would you... Remember, Moab is their home. Why would you think about leaving your own family and your own people and your own support network to go be an outcast in somebody else's land? Just think about that for a minute. What does it say about Naomi that they were willing to even think about going back to her land?
They didn't like it. It must not have liked it because they were going to give it up to go somewhere else, but they might be hated.
Or...
I
believe that this was a woman of outstanding character. That even in the midst of all this difficulty, somehow she had held it together and had enough strength about her to go on. Now, if you look in the next little bit then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you." So what's her first thought? You guys ought to just stay where you are, go back to your own families, just build a new life for yourself in your own homes. But what was that going to do to Naomi? It was going to mean that she was going to have to travel by herself, a single woman, 50, 80 miles on foot, at a time when it wasn't good to be a woman and be alone. What's the kind of courage that it takes to do that? Or what's the kind of desperation that it takes? And this is the feeling that I hope we can embrace. She has so little left to lose. I mean, what does it matter? She's lost her kids, even if they were sick and failing. I mean, she's lost them. They're not there anymore. She's lost her husband. Nothing in her life has gone well. And you can almost picture this as like, "I'm going to go. I don't want your help, because when you come along and help me, it's liable to just go, listen, everything that I care about has already died. So if you keep following me, who knows what's liable to happen to you?" And she wants them to stay where they are, and she's just resigned herself to the fact that she's going back there. And amazingly, both of them agree to go at first, and then she says, "No, no, I told you to stay." And then finally the one turns around and goes back. And the other one, Ruth, she decides that she's going to go. Let's read a little bit from verse 11. "But Naomi said, 'Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return to your home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me.'" So this is what she feels like. That she is, in a few chapters, going to be one of the heroes in this story. And this is what the hero of the story feels like. The hero of the story feels like God has abandoned her, and she's left to sort it all out for herself. Now, if you had to write a story, and you were going to write the story, and the story was going to be about the faithfulness and trustworthiness of God, would this play into the story that you would write? If you were to write a story about how God is going to do great things that are going to bless generations, is this the story that you would write? I certainly wouldn't write it this way. "At this they wept. And then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. 'Look,' said Naomi, 'your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her.' But Ruth replied, 'Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die.'" Now that's a pretty morbid thought. "Where you die, I will die. 'And there, I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth had determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now, I realize this is a girl story, but even though it's a girl story, there's a really powerful lesson to this. As bad as things were for Naomi, Ruth decided to follow her. As bad as things were, Ruth saw something worth following and was just dedicated to that. What does it take to be that person? Are you willing to just keep on pressing on in the commitment that you've made to some good thing, even if you don't see a good outcome? Because this, remember, we know the end of the story. She didn't know the end of the story. She didn't know if she was going to live even to make it back to her homeland, let alone if there was going to be anything good. And she just said, I'm going. And Ruth said, well, if you're going, I'm going. And our fates are going to be together.
Is that a parallel, like vision, like she was visioning what was going to happen? I'm just trying to compare it to some things in my life. You know, like, may not be around to see what's going to happen in the end, but is that what she's...
I'm thinking this is just a bold statement of, I would rather... I've watached you, I've seen you, I've seen how you respond to crisis and difficulty, I've watched you endure hardship, and if I had to be with anybody and spend the rest of my days with anybody, I trust spending my life with you more than I trust my life back with my own people.
Very much like the disciples. Seems like just another picture of the same story that the apostles went through. They decided if they ended up on a cross, they ended up on a cross, but it's better than going back to the other road that leads nowhere.
Yeah.
Plus they left their families to be with sick and failing, so maybe their life before wasn't so great either.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about it. Their life before, yeah, that's true. They left their own families to be with sick and failing. But maybe it was, listen, if they met him at the bar, maybe they looked sick and failing, looked pretty macho, and never mind. That's a different story. We don't have time to tell that one today. All right. Take some time to read the rest of the story yourself, but we're just going to cut right to the chase here. I'm sure you know how this ends up, but in the end, Naomi guides Ruth as to... Well, let me just tell you enough of the story so that you can get the full picture. So they get home. They get into their home country. And everybody knows Naomi. Nobody knows Ruth. Obviously, nobody knows Ruth because she's never been there. But word gets around that Naomi's back. And Naomi finds a place to stay. Ruth, sensing that there's a need, says, I'm going to go out and I'm going to go harvest with the harvesters. It says that they return at the time of the barley harvest. And so it was permissible, it was acceptable, it was actually what was prescribed in the law that when you harvested your fields, you were supposed to leave a little all around the edges so that the poor could come and harvest. So if you'd lost your land, if your family had lost their land due to bad business management, bad business practices, you got into debt, you couldn't pay the debt, and your land was taken, then you had no means to support yourself. So the only way that you could support yourself once you were poor and had lost everything was to go out to somebody else's field who had land, and you were allowed to harvest at the edges of the field. As a matter of fact, harvesters were instructed to leave all the corners, all the fringe areas, so that the poor could have a place to harvest. Well, the guy that they find to harvest in his field, this Boaz guy, is incredibly charitable. He's honorable. And when he sees what's happening, he tells his own harvesters, listen, just drop some extra stuff. Don't worry about just the corners. Leave all the corners there, the typical stuff that we would do. But what I'd like you to do is actually, when you cut the grain, just let some of it fall on the ground. Pretend you dropped it. So that there'll be a little bit more. And then, as a matter of fact, I'd like you to do one more thing. I'd like you to be a little bit sloppy about the way you cut so that you leave some of it uncut. I mean, just really look like, essentially what he's telling his guys is, really look like sloppy farmers. Because if you look like sloppy farmers, there's going to be more for her to harvest. And I know that doesn't sit well with you, but listen, this woman is attentive and she's concerned and she's diligent because it says she worked from morning till night. So she's demonstrated, this Ruth gal has demonstrated real initiative and real commitment to care for the two of them. So there's a two-way stream of commitment going on. All right? Naomi has character. She has wisdom. She has intelligence. But she doesn't have the strength anymore to try to do some of this stuff. And Ruth has the strength, but maybe doesn't quite understand the way the law of the land works. And so the two of them work together. And then finally, Naomi, her final thing, and I'm not sure if I would take marriage advice from Naomi, given how her story took off, but in the end, Naomi helps Ruth to get married, and here is the result. Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, this is Ruth's child, cared for him. The woman living there said, Naomi has a son. Now this is important, because Naomi has lost everything she had. And so what Naomi has actually is a grandson, and they named him Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So here's the amazing thing about the way this story ends. Hey, in Jewish culture, to be worthy of anything, you had to be a pure Jew. As a matter of fact, that's why there's, you know all the boring genealogies in the Bible, they're sprinkled about just about the time you think there's something interesting to read. There's another one of those pesky genealogies with so-and-so who begat so-and-so who begat so-and-so. And three chapters into it, you've lost all interest in whoever begat anybody, right? But the reason that they're all there is because it was intended to establish your Jewish purity uninterrupted. Jesus is of the line of David. Do you know what that means? It means that Jesus is a half-breed. By the language of the day, Jesus has mixed blood. Now that's really interesting. You would think that God would plan that his Redeemer would be pure Jewish. He wouldn't have him defiled by being part of those pagan cultures. And yet the amazing thing is, God loves the whole world so much that he was interested in having the whole world's blood incorporated into the Messiah. And that is the outcome of Naomi's faithfulness to stay the course in spite of the fact that there was absolutely no guarantee of anything good coming about. So when you and I are stuck deep in the crap of life and we think that God has abandoned us, I wouldn't recommend you name your kids sick and failing when things are not going well. Okay, I wouldn't recommend that. But when we think that God has completely abandoned us after we've tried to do the right things, don't lose heart. If you've made a commitment to do the right thing, don't be surprised when life is difficult for long seasons of time. Don't be surprised when you don't hear from God. You know, one of the things, and we've talked about this before, but maybe some of you haven't heard this, Mother Teresa was very adamant in her will, stating that she did not want her personal journals ever to be released and read. And people couldn't understand why, but somehow there was some court that was instrumental in having that overturned so that her journals were made a little bit more public. And what they found out when they opened her journals and what they figured out as to why she didn't ever want these closed books to be opened was the number of entries that she made about how, I think God has abandoned me. I don't sense the voice of God at all. I feel like I'm doing this all alone and God is nowhere to be seen. I'll just have to keep on doing this work because I think it's the right thing to do, but I'm just not sure where God is. And in light of the fact that later on in her life she was recognized for her work, and in spite of the fact that she didn't want to be idolized, how many times have we used the phrase like Mother Teresa, right? It's even become part of our American lingo about the way we describe virtuous people. And in spite of all that, what's her feeling? Her feeling, this woman that we think is this great godly woman, her feeling is, I think maybe God has abandoned me and just left me to do this work myself. And isn't that the way we can all feel from time to time? So I guess my encouragement to you, and it's pretty small encouragement, is that we shouldn't be surprised when we feel that way at times, maybe even for long seasons of life, even after we've made what we believe to be the right and godly choices. Okay?